Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Good morning. You're listening to WBFO, your NPR station. I'm Michael Loss. Thank you for tuning in to this special edition of What's Next. During the next hour, we're going to feature conversations and interviews with our WBFO staff discussing Governor Kathy Hochul's State of the State address that was held last week. We'll hear from local legislators on both sides of the aisle, political experts, and advocates who care deeply about the topics presented in the address. We start by featuring a conversation with WBFO reporter Ryan Zunner that covers free community college education and childcare.
We can't talk about the future without talking about education. It is the great equalizer, unlocking opportunity for all. And working with our legislature, again, I thank you, for the last 2 years, we've more than doubled tuition assistance at SUNY and CUNY and expanded eligibility. But now we're going even bolder. We're going to make community college completely free for students age 25 to 55.
That's how Governor Hochul kicked off the education portion of her State of the State address, coupling education with opportunity, leading to greater success for individuals, families, and ultimately the greater workforce of New York State. The first point, as you heard, was a plan to make community college free for students aged 25 to 55. It would apply for people entering high-demand fields, among which include teaching, manufacturing, nursing, and a wide range of technology careers. It will even include the cost of books and other associated materials. Not only could it provide a steady stream right to the workforce, but Dean of Buffalo State University's School of Education, Dr. Wendy Patterson, says associate degree programs are often a foundation for students pursuing more advanced degrees.
The feeding of the two-year colleges into the comprehensive colleges has fallen off significantly. And that has posed some huge problems for both the two-year colleges and for us, because they're feeders for us. And that is that our enrollments are challenged. And when enrollments go down, programs are threatened. So lower enrollment, fewer options for students. So putting some funding to support career-oriented degree programs at the community college level is a good first step.
Patterson also says the inclusion of teaching as a high-demand and high-priority field is a big win.
Teaching isn't usually included in that. And so for us who are trying to respond to the dire teacher and leader shortages in New York State, this is good news. Really, the two-year colleges are very important pipelines.
One of those districts feeling the brunt of teacher shortages is Buffalo Public Schools. Board of Education Vice President Larry Scott says they struggle to fill the positions they're budgeted for.
We have a shortage in education, people wanting to pursue a career in education, being teachers, being mental health professionals. And I believe the free tuition includes pursuing education and a career of education, for education. So I think that would certainly be a motivator for many of our high school graduates to consider going to college to pursue a career in education, and especially in urban education, where we need special education teachers. We need ENL teachers, English as a new language. We need science teachers. We need math teachers, reading teachers.
Democratic State Assemblyman Bill Conrad, whose district includes much of northern Erie County and parts of southern Niagara County, says he's seen firsthand in the wake of the Sumitomo tire plant closure the wave of local companies hiring skilled workers.
I've been doing a job fair for Sumitomo employees recently, and we keep coming across places that are just like, we need employees. We need them to be able to do this skill, and we need them trained.
But he's also hoping the governor considers how funding works for community colleges.
And right now, if it is like the Excelsior program where the state just gives the money to the institution, that's great. But right now, under the chargeback formula, if someone from Erie County attends Niagara Community College, that county is then charged back for them going there, and thus the community they come from have that subtracted from their essentially their allotment from the county. So Amherst, Tonawanda, Tonawanda, Kenmore, and Grand Island have always kind of lost out on dollars because of the chargeback issue.
Hochul also proposed a massive public investment into childcare and daycare centers across the state to the tune of $110 million, starting a pathway towards what she calls universal childcare. Dr. Patterson says not only expanding the availability of childcare, but the quality of childcare can have profound positive impacts on academic outcomes and childhood development.
I've read some research in the past about something as simple as comparing two families, and in one family where they talk to their kids and take them to the grocery store and include them in problem solving, and where there's a lot of interchange and thought exchange and talk. They come to school with about 1,000 hours of experience in English language arts already, which is why they acquire reading and literacy faster. And this has been proven in research, many kinds of research. Those students who do not have that, and sometimes this is culturally connected, or it's connected to parents, two parents who work and don't have time with their kids. There's not a whole lot of interaction between adults and kids, particularly in language. And they come to that same first year in school with less than 200, 250 hours of considerable practice in English language arts. Now, that's a huge inequity. So supporting childcare and early preschool kinds of programs with people who are certified and educated is a really, really good step.
Assemblyman Conrad knows that cost as a father and former high school teacher.
I have four kids. I've had to pay for childcare, and it's quite expensive and can be kind of a dip. In fact, at one point, my wife decided to stay home from work to be able to take care of her kids because it was the affordability issue. So I'm very interested to see how we do this, because there is a shortage of people providing that work, the centers to do it. It's got to be a top-to-bottom approach, and I'm really interested to see what the details are about this, because I certainly am supportive of the idea.
Affordability for a number of things is an issue for New Yorkers and really all Americans. An Ipsos poll over the summer found 50% of Americans ranked cost of living as their number one concern heading into November's election. Governor Hochul tried to meet those concerns in the State of the State address by offering a massive increase to the state child tax credit.
This year, I want to support our families even more, tripling the maximum benefit to $1,000. $1,000 for babies and kids up to four, and in 2026, will boost the credit for school-age children even higher to $500.
Conrad argues child tax credits are a way to lift families up from poverty, but is optimistic on the execution of the proposal.
I think child tax credits are one of the best movers out of poverty that you can offer for a community to help families. At the same time, tripling it, I want to know where these funds are going to come from and how's the structure going to look.
Republican State Senator George Borrello believes expanding the child tax credit doesn't solve the root issues of families in his district of Allegheny, Chautauqua, and parts of Livingston County who are facing financial struggles.
She's talking about essentially a $5,000 for a family of five. Okay, so we'll call it a parents and three children or whatever it might be, or maybe a single parent and four children. But $5,000 compared to the burdens that have been placed largely by her and my Democrat colleagues far outweigh that. We've seen massive increases in utility costs. I hear that almost daily from my constituents, that the prices of electricity, natural gas, everything is going up. The pain that they feel going to the grocery store, that's largely caused by, you know, inflation causing bad policies, including, quite frankly, you know, raising the minimum wage, which has created wage compression and increases on everything.
Buffalo Board of Education Vice President Larry Scott says an increase in the child tax credit could prove positive indirect results for families in urban communities like Buffalo Public Schools.
Providing those basic needs for our students, food, clothing, a warm house, but then also any type of educational materials that the students need could potentially benefit from that tax credit. So it's those indirect necessities that hopefully will be better addressed among our families that are living in poverty, that are low income, and allow those students to be more prepared when they do enter our school buildings.
Governor Hochul also used part of her State of the State address to present her Unplug and Play initiative that promotes extracurricular and recreational activities for students. It's partly for mental health, and Dr. Patterson from Buffalo State says it also can improve learning.
I am one of those incredibly rabid proponents of play and playful learning. Play is really important. It's the very, very first way that children learn anything. But I think that one of the inequities that I've seen, again, from wealthy districts to not so wealthy districts, is recess and the availability of playground apparatus and things that are external to the classroom. And I think it's because when a district is pressed for funds, they focus on the academic funds and they don't always connect the playgrounds and the state that they're in and the number of hours the kids can spend just in free play with the learning experience.
While Unplug and Play certainly is aimed at getting kids off phones and outside and active, what Hochul didn't mention during the State of the State was statewide framework for cell phone policies in schools, something she conducted listening sessions on over the summer and something education leaders want to see, like Scott from the Buffalo School Board.
This has been something that she's been talking about for about a year now, at least. I see firsthand how it impacts my own children, how it impacts students in schools. So I'm looking forward to see what type of guidance that she's going to provide to school districts across New York State in regards to cell phone and devices.
Dr. Patterson also sees cell phone use as something that needs to be addressed, along with students using AI.
My fear is, and I know some educators feel the same way, that without some kind of impetus or guidelines to empower teachers to have cell phone free classrooms, or to somehow guide the teachers and the schools into what is appropriate use of AI, we are going to have students who are damaged by never interacting with real people in significant ways.
That was Ryan Zunner breaking down some of the education initiatives presented in the address. We now move over to a segment where Jim Fink analyzes some of the affordable housing options presented.
A stable home is the foundation of a stable life. But for far too many New Yorkers, it's a dream that feels impossibly out of reach. And I'm not the first one to say this, but the rent is too damn high.
Since taking office in 2021, Governor Kathy Hochul has made the drive to create more affordable housing options available in New York State as one of the key legislative cornerstones of her administration. Hochul's goal, to create at least 100,000 new affordable housing options statewide within the next 5 years. She said in her State of the State address that we are almost halfway there.
And that goes for people's mortgages as well. Housing is the number one driver of our affordability crisis. And the only way to decrease housing costs is to increase supply. We need to build and build and build some more.
Supporters, and there are many, acknowledge that while it is an aggressive plan, it is one worth pursuing. Safe and secure home ownership is a basic tenet, to be sure, but is also, from an urban planning perspective, it helps create a sense of community and spin off economic impacts such as retailing options and more services available. Critics say Hochul's plan is too pie in the sky, with little supportive teeth beyond the proposal. Affordable housing options need to pencil out, and the current drive, despite tax breaks incentives, does not do that. Developer Alex Severin, who has quite an experience in developing, agrees with that assessment.
I think the issue is that inventory cannot be created fast enough or for a price that makes sense for an entry-level home.
Hochul is determined in her quest for more affordable housing options in the state. She remains determined. Affordable housing was one of the key talking points in Hochul's January 14th State of the State address. One of the highlights, the Pro Housing Community Program, which will allocate $100 million in a revolving fund aimed at spurring mixed-income rental development outside of New York City. It is a proposed initiative that could bode well for Western New York. Steve Hagsma, Housing Opportunity Made Equal Education Manager, said the initiative is absolutely needed on so many levels.
Yeah, there definitely is a focus. I think it's important to have that focus. And honestly, I think that the fact that the governor is focusing on housing is as important as the details of the plan. Not that those don't matter, but the fact that housing is a priority is very important, because if we just let the status quo continue, let the current trends continue, then even more people are going to be priced out of good housing, and people are going to have to make those tough decisions of, all right, what am I going to pay this month? Am I going to pay my rent, or am I going to pay my other bills?
And State Senator Sean Ryan, who is also running for Buffalo mayor, agrees that the initiative is long overdue and could spark a new wave of affordable housing options.
So these programs will give people the pride of home ownership, get more units on the market, build generational wealth, but also fill in the gap that are all over Buffalo's neighborhood. Yep, it's about time that we got here. It took longer than I would have liked to get here, but I'm thankful that we're here now, and the governor realizes how important these programs are to revitalizing places like Buffalo.
In recent years, there have been some inroads made locally, especially in the city of Buffalo, to create more affordable housing options. Former schools that have sat empty have been renovated into apartments. A concerted effort is underway to turn empty lots in the Fillmore District that sit in the shadow of the Central Terminal and turn those lots into new houses. The Buffalo Municipal Housing Authority is undertaking a $1 billion makeover of its Perry, Marine Drive, and Schaefer Village complexes that will collectively add more apartments that are also geared towards the affordable market. But Hagsma from Home says those are early steps. More, much more, is needed.
Housing designated affordable housing and the market rate units that are available. The affordability is definitely not as good as it was 5 years ago. I mean, before the pandemic, rents were a lot more manageable, and rents have grown at a rate that far exceeds how much incomes have grown in the last 5 years or so.
Other new initiatives Hochul championed in her State of the State address was to put more restrictions on hedge funds and private equity firms when it comes to acquiring single-family homes whose tenant base would be those in the low to moderate or affordable income brackets. The focus is on single-family homes and not apartment complexes. That is an important differential. The proposal targets more than of New York City market than West New York, most say. Part of the restrictions include not allowing hedge funds or private equity firms to bid on available single-family homes until they have been on the market for at least 75 days.
And we also have to take a hard stance against the private equity firms that have strangled some of the housing markets across the country. We've seen it. You know what happens. Young family finds the home they've been searching for. They're so excited. They scrape together every dollar they have. And then they lose out to an all-cash offer from a faceless, nameless corporation with no connection to the community. Corporate landlords co-opt our housing stock for short-term rentals as well. Or even worse, they just let them sit there vacant while the values soar, and we need every one of them.
The proposal is not sitting well at all with the development investment community. And remember, hedge funds and equity firms own more than 500,000 homes nationwide, and that number continues to grow. Alex Severin, co-founder with his twin brother, Bill, of Severin Development, says the proposal is not necessary and unfairly targets his industry.
When we started looking at acquiring and keeping our single-family homes, we got some negative pushback from some of our equity investors. They were concerned about a couple of things. They were concerned about rent control. They were concerned about laws like what's being currently proposed, about limiting landlords' rights to buy properties. And honestly, with the property taxes where they are, it's not a great place to invest.
Severin also feels that the proposal may shift investment dollars away from New York to other states like Ohio, where they are now operating.
I mean, it's because everyone knows that the property taxes are high, the legislation is tough on investors, and financially even the asset prices are already too expensive because of a limited inventory issue. So I mean, we have to gravitate towards markets that have better laws, they're more business friendly, and their asset prices are lower because they've incentivized new construction or they've helped the creation of inventory over the last couple of years. I mean, that's why, again, we're in Cleveland.
All of Hochul's affordable housing proposals are subject to approval by state lawmakers later this year.
That was Jim Fink taking a look at some of the housing initiatives presented in the State of the State Address. We'll now listen in to Jamal Harris Jr.'s segment, talking about some of the proposed middle-class tax cuts.
One thing made clear by Governor Kathy Hochul's State of the State Address was her pandering to the middle class.
My fellow New Yorkers, as we reflect on the state of our great state, the Empire State, two things are very clear to me. Our future depends on the ability of every family to afford the essentials of life and our ability to protect the safety and security of our residents. But we will not achieve these goals without a fight. So my commitment to every New Yorker is this: your family is my fight.
Data point after data point shows people are leaving New York State en masse to live elsewhere. And the governor's response to that is her litany of new social programs she wants to bring to the state to ease expenses on New York State residents. Starting with what she called sweeping middle-class tax cuts, cutting taxes for every individual making less than $300,000 a year. These tax cuts will be coincided with child tax credits and inflation refund checks. I discussed with Democratic State Senator Sean Ryan and Republican State Senator Robert Ort, who both represent large portions of Western New York, what these tax cuts would mean and how the state can afford them. Finally, I talked with political expert Dr. Shyam Shriram, professor at Canisius University, on his thoughts of Hochul's ambitious tax plan.
The governor really hit today on what I like to call kitchen table issues, things that will lower the cost of families living in New York State. Free school lunches, increased tax deduction for children, lowering the middle class tax rate. All this helps people keep money in their pockets. And we're able to afford doing that this year because, the tax revenues came in over budget last year. The number of millionaires in New York State continues to grow, and they're helping fund the whole tax system. So that all gives us room to make these new programs and still keep our budgets balanced. But all these types of programs support middle-class families, you know, and the economy.
Now, does she plan to just cut them just, you know, for this upcoming year, or are these kind of maybe here to stay for a few years? What do you kind of think the plan is in terms of that?
Generally, once you make it into the budget, they'll stay until they're removed. So the idea is we'd be able to keep operating state government and keep the middle-class tax cuts all in place.
And how substantial do you think these cuts necessarily, you know, will be for the average family? You know, a couple hundred dollars, a couple thousand dollars?
More like all the items that the governor added up today, you know, the combination of the free school lunches, the tax deduction, the tax decreases, child care, you know, for an average family, it'll add up close to $5,000.
On the other side of the aisle, Senator Robert Orr, who does agree with the idea of middle-class tax cuts, but called on the idea for the tax cuts to be a bit more broader, as well as worrying of the long-term viability to keep the tax cuts in the state budget. You're not necessarily against that. You're just calling for the tax cuts to be a bit more broader, correct?
Yeah, more broad, and I think more of a permanent, like her. So she has two proposals, as I understand it. There's the inflation reduction move, right, which people are going to get like a check for $300 or $500. It's like a rebate check. And I would like to see, our conference would like to see something certainly larger than that. I mean, I think $300 to $500 is, no one's going to say no to that. But at the same time, I think people need the kind of relief that people need. And I think this is an important part, Jamal. Whenever we talk about these kinds of things, a tax cut, a tax rebate, a tax credit, these are all different things, but essentially we're returning people's tax dollars to them. The problem is in New York State, none of this happens in a vacuum. So at the same time the governor is proposing this, which is certainly a message that we support, at least the idea of returning people's tax dollars to them, I think the problem becomes at the same time we're doing things like increasing the cost to our farms. We're increasing cost to downstate for people to go to New York City with the congestion pricing plan. We're increasing people's energy costs, both at the gas pump and to heat their homes with some of the energy and environmental policies through the CLCPA. So those things, while you might get $300 or $500 back, the problem is New York State is taking a lot more than that over the course of a year with other policies. And so I would say this is a step in the right direction anytime we're talking about tax cuts, but I think we need to be realistic about the hurt that people are feeling, whether it's in their paycheck, whether it's when they go to the grocery store, whether it's when they turn on their heat, whether it's if they're downstate, you know, they've got to pay more to go to New York City. All these things have a negative impact on their bottom line. And so then they get the check for $500 and it's like, well, thanks, but this is, I need a lot more than this. And so we need to review not only the tax cuts, but those other policies that are increasing people's costs and making New York more expensive to live.
I kind of want to tap on that millionaires thing too. And, you know, kind of the reason we're able to do these tax cuts or whatnot is because, you know, we have more millionaires coming into the state and they're kind of be able to fund that. Do you maybe see it as a problem as we're kind of, you know, maybe relying on these millionaires and maybe relying on more of them to come back at these tax cuts? Like, do we see them, you know, maybe possibly leaving because their taxes are a little too high?
So I certainly think it's dangerous. And you could, you know, think about it from this standpoint. If you were a business and you had one customer that accounted for 40 or 50% of your business. If you lost that customer, that would be a real problem for your business model. That is what the state of New York is in. Our budget, a very large percentage is funded by 1% of New Yorkers. Now look, we are home because of New York City and Wall Street and Westchester County and some, we are home to some of the wealthiest people in the world have residences or call New York their home, and as a result, pay taxes here. But that is changing. You know, we are losing people, but I also think that, you know, we're losing a lot of middle-income people. That's who, you know, if you're rich, you can afford taxes. That's the problem. If, you know, people always talk about this. Some of my colleagues across the aisle, including Senator Ryan, sometimes talk about this like a class warfare thing. And I see it from a very different angle in that the wealthiest people in New York, they pay some of the highest taxes, but they're not moving because, in some cases, because it doesn't affect their day-to-day lives, right? They're able to absorb the hit, or they're able to put their money in tax shelters, you know, offshore. They have the accountants to make sure they're paying as little as possible. The person who pays the most tax as part of their income, and the people who are leaving, are that middle income, people who retire, young people who are starting their careers. These are the people we're losing, because for them, it does change their life. It changes the house they can buy. It changes the car they drive. It changes their future economic outlook in some cases. And so I think it's always a danger when we just assume we're going to have all these millionaires coming in, paying the load. But I also think it's a danger that you're chasing out. I don't want a state that is composed of millionaires, billionaires, and the poorest of the poor. If we have no middle class, if we are eviscerating and contributing to the evisceration of the middle class in New York State, that is a bad thing. It's bad for our politics. It's bad for our economy. And by the way, a lot of those millionaires and billionaires, they're employers and they need employees. And the reason many of those places leave New York is because they cannot find a talent pool. And guess where that talent pool comes from or where they're going? They're going to Florida. They're going to Tennessee, they're going to North Carolina, they're going to Texas, and that's, I think, a larger issue for the state.
Dr. Shriram also shared a similar cautious sentiment with Senator Ort.
But as a common meme is now, I would say, the math isn't mathing, right? What is the fiscal math? Because if you're going to say that there's going to be this huge tax cut, and I looked it up, allegedly it will affect 8.3 million people. You know, it's a huge amount of money, but there's a part of me that doesn't, in this way, I think that one of the common criticisms of the state of the state from Democrats and Republicans has been, how is this going to add up, right? I mean, if you're going to suggest a $1 billion tax cut, how will that be offset? It'll probably be offset by taxing something else in the future. So the short answer to your question is that I'm skeptical because I don't know how this is going to be balanced in the future.
That was Jamal Harris Jr. going more in depth into the middle class tax cuts presented by Governor Kathy Hochul. We turn our attention now to the environment, where Alex Simone will go in depth as to some of the climate conscious initiatives Kathy Hochul is desiring for a zero carbon emissions New York State.
We are the first generation to truly experience the effects of climate change, and we are the last generation that can do anything about it. And that's why, despite intense opposition, I signed the Climate Change Superfund Act, passed by the legislature, and declared it should be the big corporate polluters who should pay for the consequences of climate change instead of New York taxpayers.
Hochul signed the legislation in December, requiring large fossil fuel producers to pay billions of dollars toward climate-conscious initiatives as a penalty for past pollution. University at Buffalo environmental sociology professor Holly Buck says putting the Superfund Act into practice might be easier said than done, but it demonstrates New York's dedication toward making a change.
They expect that this would face legal challenges, and there's other bills already undergoing in Vermont, for example, and proposed in other northeastern states along these lines. They'll probably all face different types of lawsuits. So I'll be interested to see how that all goes. I do think that level of funding would be important for the adaptation needs we have. It would get us part of the way to the estimates of how much it will cost to adapt to a warming climate.
Another legislative piece that would have major implications is the cap and invest proposal, which would set a cap on emissions and decline over time to help meet Hochul's goal of having net zero emissions by 2050. Under the proposal, companies would be required to bid on allowances equivalent to their level of emissions for the year, with one allowance offsetting one ton of carbon pollution. Buffalo Niagara Partnership Director of Government Affairs Josh Veronica says it's a positive sign that Kathy Hochul and state politicians have held off on passing the legislation.
This was going to be something operational in 2025. I believe it was this year. And now
they're going to take. So they had issued some proposed regulations last year that the business community has some significant concerns with. We're encouraged that she is pausing implementation because I think she's recognizing the impact at Cap and Invest, and in particular, a hastily developed Cap and Invest program would have on businesses and have on consumers. So we're eager to see, you know, over the next 12 months, what a new program would look like as that's developed.
Some members of the climate advocacy group New York Renews feel like not enough changes are being made. New York Renews Executive Director Stefan Edel says there needs to be more action as opposed to fancy words.
I think those things that take a little bit of political power and a little bit of dedication, you know, we don't see the administration following through on or elevating. And, you know, that's really concerning. The governor has had a lot of opportunities to really implement fully the CLCPA, the state's landmark climate law. And we've just seen pretty clear examples up to and including now where the governor is saying, you know, it's too hard to do what we know has to be done. So let's take our time and slow down.
The Cap and Invest plan would also use rebates to incentivize companies taking steps toward green energy technology and zero emission upgrades. National Grid isn't waiting to work toward these new standards. The electric supplier already has started $4 billion in upgrades to improve the electric line infrastructure around Western New York. National Grid spokesman David Bertola says work already started last year in areas like Batavia and Dunkirk. He says the challenge with improving the electric grid is that the demands are different from when many of the lines were installed.
When it was designed and when it was installed, it wasn't done with an eye toward electric vehicles or electric buildings or homes coming online. It was to serve the purpose for the population at large. And as technology and demand is changing, it's aggressive, and that's why we have to be on top of it.
But Adel says some of Hochul's actions run counter to her message, like with the Buffalo Bills' new stadium being built in Orchard Park. Adel says Hochul's advocation for the team to receive hundreds of millions of dollars in state funding shows how impactful her full support can be. And he's concerned about the tons of material waste that are generated as a byproduct of construction.
The governor came in and said, this is something important to me. I want to make it happen. And she did. And on a whole host of issues, climate policy among them, we haven't seen that level of clarity and leadership. And so if the governor wants to find $1 billion for something, the governor can find $1 billion for something. When she made that decision, she also chose to move that forward without doing the required analysis. The climate law says when you make a major investment, when you make a policy decision, you have to stop and ask, is this going to help us meet our climate goals?
During her state address, Hochul did verbally support further funding toward clean energy this year. She highlighted the importance of increasing options that would be needed to reach the goal of zero emissions by 2050.
We've also recommitted to reducing carbon emissions with our offshore wind off the coast of Long Island, hydroelectric power coming in from Quebec to power New York City. And just this year, I'm calling for an historic $1 billion investment to further the transition to a zero emission economy. We're going to build power ready sites for green industry.
Veronica says one reason he sees promise is Hochul showing support for nuclear power, not just options like wind and solar.
In her booklet, she announced launching a New York master nuclear plan. Basically saying that the state is going to take a look at adding nuclear energy to its electricity portfolio. As the state takes coal and natural gas plants offline, we're not building solar and wind generation facilities fast enough to be able to replace that load and still meet our climate goals.
Buck says many people are worried about whether the current power supply would be able to handle the push for more buildings and vehicles to go electric. But the diversity of energy resources is why she has confidence in the state's ability to significantly decrease carbon emissions in the coming years.
Will the electricity be there when they need it to be? And I think that actually the power sector is one of the easier things to decarbonize. We have a lot of resources, especially in Western New York State, like hydropower, wind, solar. We could have a resurgence of nuclear again. There's a lot of different options for decarbonizing the power sector.
Bertola says electric lines have to keep getting updated to handle the increased load, but new energy sources also change the needs.
This network that we're enhancing will connect more renewable energy too. So that's the other piece, right? Is that the current grid isn't built to sustain or to handle all the renewables that are going to be added. You can install a few windmills on people's property, but that still needs to be hooked up to the grid so the clean energy can be delivered to your house.
That was Alex Simone taking a deeper dive into some of the climate-conscious initiatives Kathy Hochul mentioned in her address. We now flip over to Emily Watkins' portion of today's show, where she analyzes some of the issues brought up in the address that are impactful to the disability and mental health communities of Western New York.
Our state must be livable and safe. My fight for your family also means New Yorkers feel secure on the streets, on our subways, in their communities. And we're going to do this with common sense measures that everyone can get behind. Because people should be able to get to work in the morning, attend a play, enjoy restaurants without the fear of random violence or dodging someone in the midst of a mental health crisis. We cannot allow our subway to be a rolling homeless shelter.
One of the more divisive stances Governor Kathy Hochul took in her State of the State address Tuesday was expanding the requirements for being involuntarily committed to inpatient mental health treatment.
Our laws must be stronger. And that's why I'm willing to stand up and say we need to expand involuntary commitment into a hospital to include someone who does not have the mental capacity to care for themselves, such as refusing help for the basics, clothing, food, shelter, medical care.
But this idea isn't new. A bill was first introduced in 2021 to make the same change. 57th District Senator George Borello, who represents much of rural Western New York, introduced the bill and continues to co-sponsor it. When asked why he has been pushing for this change, he told WBFO in part,
"We've seen the impact of folks that you know are suffering with mental illness and substance use disorders on our streets. They cannot provide for themselves. They are homeless. They are malnourished. They certainly are, you know, they are suffering from hygiene issues. And, you know, their clothes are clearly, you know, not adequate, no shelter. So these are the basic, markers of folks that are suffering from mental illness. So I think it's quite frankly, it's obvious that these are people that need help."
He, like the governor, sees it as a public safety issue.
And then you see, ultimately, even though it's a small percentage of people, many of those people end up in our criminal justice system. And unfortunately, you know, some of them end up, you know, committing acts of violence, including murder. So that is the societal issue that has to be addressed. And that's why, you know, it is a public safety issue as well for us. We have to address that public safety element of this.
This idea of expanding involuntary commitment is controversial. On the cost end, some argue inpatient treatment costs more than outpatient support. But on the social side, some worry that the state is backtracking. There's concerns over losing the personal autonomy and self-direction that people with mental health conditions fought for when the state deinstitutionalized and transitioned to outpatient care.
Well, I mean, I think that the transition came about for a number of reasons in the mid-20th century.
Michael Rembis is an associate professor of history at the University of Buffalo and an expert on institutionalization and eugenics. He recently published a book, Writing Mad Lives in the Age of the Asylum.
There was push back from below, from former residents of state institutions and current residents of state institutions who, you know, were neglected and abused by the state and not cared for properly within institutions.
This led to people with disabilities, including people with mental health conditions, advocating for alternative modes of care.
In the 1950s, governors of various states came together and realized that they couldn't afford the state institutions anymore. State governments can't run at a deficit, and so they needed to do something to undo these huge state systems that were developed in the 19th and early 20th centuries.
Remba says the development of new medications, as well as the Community Mental Health Act of 1963, continued to help more people move out of institutions and live with outpatient support.
I know the phrase involuntary commitment reminds people of the prison-like institutions of the past, but that's not the objective of these proposals. We're in a different time now.
If things have changed, why are people worried?
Well, I think that involuntary commitment is a really sensitive topic and a really important thing to consider, because people were often committed against their will in the past, brought to these large state institutions. They could be held indefinitely. You know, wives were committed by their husbands. People were committed by family members or neighbors or friends in consultation with physicians and often also in consultation with the court. But it was often quite easy to commit somebody involuntarily. And once somebody was considered, you know, back then the term would be insane, and now they would use different labels. They were not considered, you know, reliable conveyors of their own experiences. They were not considered to be sort of rational, and so they were committed against their will and often held against their will and sometimes held indefinitely and for very long.
For Maura Kelly, it's more than a sensitive topic. It's her life.
Why would I share some vulnerable stuff that might, they might lock me away because I'm sick? That just doesn't make sense. So we need a safe place, a confidential place, informed, be part of my care, part of the treatment. I want to run the show. I want my control of my life in all areas, my mental, physical, spiritual. Why can't I have that?
Kelly is an expert because she works as a behavioral health peer liaison at Western New York Independent Living, where she represents and advocates for Western New Yorkers like her with severe mental health conditions.
We're targeting the wrong problem. The problem isn't serious mentally ill people in our community. The problem is there aren't services available.
Kelly says instead of focusing on committing people, the state should focus on fixing the mental health system itself.
So people are asking, they get help, it's terrible, and then, oh, why don't you want to get help again? Because people with mental illness are not thinking right. They're not dumb. They're not, if something bad happens or hey, you have a negative experience, it's like going out for a restaurant, you don't want to go there anymore. So targeting on those people that aren't getting care, well, let's get some care, that some care that people want and choose and are treated with dignity and respect and compassion, the way the governor wants to treat everyone in our communities with compassion, with their families. Well, we want compassion too. We don't just become subway pushers. You know, there's a lot that happens before we get that bad. Speaking from someone that used to be homeless.
So what I have said to individuals who have shared concern that they feel as though this is, you know, a slippery slope in which they end with no rights, I say I'm going to fight like hell to make sure that that's not the case.
55th District Senator and Chair of the Senate's Mental Health Committee, Samra Brook, who represents East Rochester, doesn't support expanding involuntary commitment.
What concerns me is that we have barely scratched the surface of building up a workforce, of building the supportive housing we need, of making sure beds are back online, of making sure that the community resources are funded and staffed in each of our communities. We have barely scratched the surface on doing so many of those things to so boldly revert to a very antiquated approach of essentially locking people up and throwing away the key and stripping them of civil rights.
But a narrative linking violence and mental health can also have negative public health implications, including on how patients are treated when they seek care. It's also contested if mental health impacts the prevalence of violence. One study showed that excluding people impacted by substance use, when comparing neighborhood controls and recently released mental health patients, there was no significant difference in the prevalence of violence. Violence in both groups also mostly took place at home and was targeted at family and friends.
Way back in the 19th century, that violence was used as a sort of rhetorical or discursive tool, you know, to expand asylums and to commit people. And people weren't necessarily violent, and they were often the victims of violence.
As our state looks to the future at how our mental health system can better serve people with severe mental health conditions, we asked Rembis what people should be keeping in mind about the contributions of, or what we historically know about, the people we're talking about. He had this to say.
People don't need to be exceptional in order to be accepted in society. I think we need to be inclusive of all people in society and people with mental illness or mental health labels don't need to be exceptional in order to be accepted in society. We need to accept all people and meet them on their own terms and support people to live their best lives.
That was Emily Watkins taking a better look at some of the issues important to the disability and mental health community. For the final segment of today's show, Ryan Zunner talks about some of the public safety initiatives that the governor brought up and how they can protect the people of Western New York.
There's another fight that I'll continue to take on. Our state must be livable and safe. My fight for your family also means New Yorkers feel secure on the streets, on our subways, in their communities. And we're going to do this with common sense measures that everyone can get behind. Because people should be able to get to work in the morning, attend a play, enjoy restaurants without the fear of random violence.
Governor Kathy Hochul certainly made the situation on New York City subways a main point of the public safety section of her State of the State address. But other areas have far-reaching impacts, such as in Western New York, things like domestic violence, discovery laws, coordination between law enforcement agencies, and bail reform.
And when it comes to repeat offenders, I want them off the streets. And I want judges statewide to use all the powers in our recent bail law changes to stop the rinse and repeat cycle of offenders being released over and over without consequences, only to commit more crimes again.
Hochul's mention of bail laws didn't come with calls for new modifications. What it did come with was a call to judges to utilize a power given to them in a previous reform, something former Democratic Erie County District Attorney John Flynn and current partner at firm Lippis Mathias says is welcomed.
What the governor's referring to is the changes that she made in 2023, which again, to give her credit, were in my opinion, significant, okay? What she's talking about now, what she verbally mentioned at the State of the State was that the harm analysis that judges now can use needs to be used by judges.
What is a harm analysis, and when does it come into play? When someone who is arrested for one crime is arrested for another while the first crime is still pending.
So now he's got two charges. Now, what a judge can do is that a judge now who let him out on number one, the DA's office can go back now to number one and say, judge, we want you to put bail on crime number one because he committed crime number two while crime number one was pending. And a judge now has the ability to go back and put bail and change their mind, basically, on crime number one, because Joe Smith, committed a crime, a harm crime, two crimes, while in a matter of months, okay? And so judges need to use that tool. I applaud the governor for calling judges out, because quite frankly, a lot of them don't do that. A lot of them, a lot of them just aren't using that harm analysis. DA's offices across the state are asking for it, and judges just aren't doing it.
Republican State Senator Patrick Gallivan, whose district composes areas of Erie, Wyoming, Livingston, and Monroe counties, says those 2023 changes haven't been enough.
We still have repeat offenders that are out there, that are going out there time and again. Look at what takes place, especially in our cities, and there's no fear of being held accountable. And people are, they continue to victimize others. They continue to victimize our communities. And people across New York State do not feel as safe as they did 5 or 10 years ago. And that's a problem. And it does start with the policies, the bail laws in particular. There's been some minor changes, but yet we remain the only state in the nation that does not allow a judge to consider an individual's dangerousness to the community when they're making a determination when to hold that individual or remand that individual.
Gallivan, who was once Erie County Sheriff, says he isn't totally anti-bail reform. He pointed to New Jersey's reforms that were passed in a bipartisan fashion and with 62% of voter support in a referendum. It eliminated cash bail, which has been criticized as punitive in nature.
They made a change around the same time that New York made a change. The difference is, though, that the judges use a risk assessment tool, and among the things that the judges are able to consider is the individual who's been arrested, their dangerousness to the community. And if they feel that they're more of a danger to the community, if the risk is greater than it should be, those judges have the ability to remand that individual to a holding center until the case is adjudicated. And as a result, the changes that New Jersey has made in their bail laws have been much more successful as far as preserving public safety in the communities in New Jersey than it has in New York State.
Reforms to discovery laws were another topic of Governor Hochul's State of the State. Discovery is the evidence-sharing process that is a tenet of the modern criminal justice system. She said it's caused some very serious cases to be dismissed on technicalities because of its tying to the speedy trial clock, something former DA Flynn had seen firsthand.
I applaud the governor's office for making tweaks on bail reform over the past couple of years, but the discovery, quite frankly, has been our biggest problem in prosecutor's offices and DA's offices across the state. If a judge rules that, yeah, due to some technicality, the DA's office forgot to give you page 59 out of a 100-page document, okay, one page, and they inadvertently, that page for whatever reason, like, didn't get turned over, I'm going to now withdraw their certification 3 months ago, and I'm going to retroactively go back and start to clock ticking from day one, and oh, guess what? Your time has expired now, case dismissed. So that obviously is a problem.
Hochul's proposal would make discovery errors proportional rather than a one-size-fits-all technicality. Senator Gallivan says he understands there needs to be a balance.
So discovery in and of itself is necessary, but we have to have realistic timelines to follow so that cases are not lost on a technicality because it becomes impossible for the police and the prosecutors to follow that set of rules. The other thing that discovery has had to do with the changes that has created a negative effect is that early identification of witnesses, the releasing of addresses, identifying witnesses, the name and address, which has contributed to fewer people wanting to come forward to be a witness for fear of their life or for fear of retaliation.
Domestic violence is something close to Governor Hochul. She told the New York Times in 2023 that her grandmother was a survivor of domestic abuse, and her mother was a strong advocate for survivors during her lifetime.
Her own home life was tough when she was young. Before she died, we worked side by side to create a safe haven for women and children who'd been abused. I saw in those children's eyes as we brought them into this shelter, there was no love. They'd not been raised with love. That's something they would carry with them the rest of their lives. All those kids deserve better. My mom would be so proud of the work we're doing today. So proud. And we're also working closely with law enforcement to apprehend and prosecute the rapists and to keep guns out of the hands of abusers.
Her State of the State plan makes many proposals to increase support for victims, resources for law enforcement, and training for medical providers.
The cooperation of the police, of the prosecutors, of the victim advocates in those entities is extremely important, and that's always a challenge, trying to get people together, sharing information, and working towards the same goals, which is, of course, to reduce domestic violence.
The governor's proposals in some version are typically included in the state legislature one house bill, which is typically debated and voted on in March.
And that will do it for today's special edition of What's Next. We thank our WBFO reporters who conducted the interviews featured in today's episode and broke down Governor Kathy Hochul's State of the State address. A huge thank you to Ryan Zunner, Jamal Harris Jr., Emily Watkins, Alex Simone, and Jim Fink for their work in today's episode. I'm Michael Loss. Thank you for listening to this special edition of What's Next. You're listening to WBFO, WBFO HD1 Buffalo, WOLN Olean, and WUBJ Jamestown, your NPR station.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.